Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Business Roundtable. I'm your host, Vagram Radian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. A big drop on Wall Street after more disappointing tech news, this time from Meta. Airbus, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and Northrop Grumman and others report earnings. The U.S. Air Force picks Anduril and General Atomics as finalists for the first tranche of its new unmanned combat drone. Britain will increase defense spending, and French President Emmanuel Macron again argues it's time for Europe to be less dependent on America or China militarily and economically, especially as both of those great powers, the French president claims, are undermining the rules-based free trade system, and the discovery that Russia compromised EU parliamentarians. Joining me today to discuss all this and more are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Securities, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London, and Richard Abalafi of the Aerodynamic Advisory Consultancy here in Washington, D.C. Everybody, thanks very much for joining us. I hope everybody's having a good weekend. Ron, start us off. Right. Another tough week on the street. At one point, it was the S&P was down. I think it was more than 700 some odd points, leveled out about at half that. What are the drivers and how did the group perform and discuss interest rate impacts? Right. I mean, everybody is now looking. It's amazing how the narrative week to week on the street changes. Right. From, you know, soft landing, no landing, things are great. Oh, wow, things are now too great. Oh, wow, now things are so great. The Fed is going to cut rates. And now the focus now is more on yields, right? Which is going to have an impact on everybody, especially if you've got to raise equity. Anyway, walk us through the performance of the group. It was a big earnings week. And then sort of contrast that, and we'll get to earnings in a second. But also want to get everybody's sense on this yield issue and how it's going to really affect things going forward.
So, I mean, the best way to describe the week, it was a volatile week. As of kind of the last trading day we got here, the S&P was actually up 1.4% on the week. When you look across the A&D group, it's really kind of mixed. Northrop was a champ. It ended up almost 5%. GE almost up almost 8%. Embraer up 4%, Boeing down almost 2%, GD down 2%, Lockheed was flat, Raytheon was flat, and Textron was down almost 10%. So there was a kind of a mixed bag. You just can't say defense to build a commercial or whatever. There was a lot of company-specific stuff going on. Broadly speaking, companies had strong top lines, good backlogs, but you had a mixed margin picture, varying from company to company. The VIX index, that thing we watch that measures sort of fear and loathing in the market, was at around 16. It's been higher, it's been lower, sort of middling. Now, what you mentioned was the 10-year yield. The 10-year yield is now at 4.7%, and it's been trending higher. So, there's something we've been watching here on the podcast. It bottomed out, kind of that three, almost 100 basis points lower. And it's working its way back to this 4.85% level. And a lot of folks think now that we'll see the 10-year yield go back to 5%. And that would
be the first time in like 16 years, right?
Yeah, so. It would be the first time in a long time. But here's the thing, right? One, this expectation that the Fed was going to cut back to really low interest rates was just sort of wrong. I'm not an economist. I'm not a strategist, but from a historical perspective, and we've said this a number of times, interest rates at kind of 4.5%, 5%, that's pretty middling. I mean, when you look at the whole global, right, couple thousand years of interest rates, which we have, surprisingly, it's just not that much. So we're seeing inflation being a little bit stickier, and because of that, the expectation, I think we went in the year, the Fed was going to cut maybe 150 basis points. Now what's priced in the market, the Fed might cut 35 basis points. And I think most people think now the Fed won't cut at all. It's got pushed into next year. Oil, we track that. Surprisingly, given all the weirdness in the world today, Brent crude is just under 90 bucks, 89. And WTI, you guessed it, is 84. That's where they trade. But, call it what, 85 to 90 in that range. It's been that way a while, and sort of independent of what's going on in the world. But a real question does become in a market where you're going back to 5% yields. One of the things you have to bear in mind, that's money that is not expensive, but not free. And that has implications for, you know, private equity investments, you know, venture capital investments, you know, how much you're going to pay for debt, that whole thing. And in particular, that has, you know, the way those yields work, if you become, you go from an investment grade bond to a high yield bond, you get more spread on top of that, right? So we can talk about it in a minute, but, you know, I think this is one of the reasons why Boeing mentioned they might raise some equity.
Exactly right, which was sort of the, one of the headline statements from you know, all the earnings we saw, and we'll get to that in a second. Sash, sort of give us your sense on performance of the aerospace and defense group in Europe against the broader market. And again, and Richard, right, no surprise, I'm going to come to you in a second about this yield question and how folks ought to be thinking about it, because we keep talking about the firms being under more and more margin pressure, right, ultimately, and if every little bit counts, whether in a political race or running running a major company. Sash, take it away.
Yeah, it's been a really funny week. I mean, I can't actually quite believe the performance numbers that I'm looking at, you know, now as we effectively go to press, because it's felt a way worse week for the aerospace and defense sector than actually it's turned out to be. I mean, it's been a real sort of bathtub profile of performance this week. So, you know, the European markets, UK's down about 1%, Germany's down about 1%, and France is up, you know, a couple of basis points. The aerospace and defense sector overall is up about 1.5%. Civil up about 1.7 and defense up 1.4. Really didn't feel like that in the middle of the week when the defense sector was getting, or subsector was getting, absolutely hammered, and most of the stocks we were looking at down somewhere between 3% and 5%. There was a real bout of profit taking. And then the results that came out from the civil stocks, Airbus, Safran in particular, they were the two big ones over here, weren't generally good enough to support the share prices. So they had pretty sticky performance. Airbus, worst of the major stocks this week, I mean, off just under 3%. And so it felt a much worse week just looking at individual share prices than actually the headlines are saying towards the end of it. But you're absolutely right, you know, rising yields, or rather yields not falling as fast as the market expected, that causes investors to reassess the attractiveness of equities and the likely profitability, or indeed the financing requirements of stocks going forwards. Now, our view is that's going to affect the defense stocks way less than the civil aerospace stocks, because ultimately the defense stocks are going to be funded by government debt and possibly even higher taxes. But civil stocks, where demand ultimately comes from propensity and affordability of flying, and that drops through to the manufacturers, that's certainly an issue that gets badly affected. And financing of aircraft is clearly rate sensitive.
You know, I said big concerns, and I should have said that it affects, you know, everybody, right? At the end of the day, Richard, how should we think about this? How are folks thinking about it, right? Because the more expensive everything is, the more expensive everything is, and it has a, you know, trickle down effect, right? I mean, I know that might seem intuitive, but walk us through what kind of impacts this is going to have, and we'll get, you know, to Boeing, or if you want to jump the shark on Boeing, you're more than welcome. Welcome to, right. But what does this mean, especially if you're going to try to raise a lot of money? And if you're Dave Calhoun, you know, you say you need $50 billion for your new airplane. By the way, great piece on that in your monthly letter. Anyway, walk us through, you know, how you see this issue and the impact you think it's going to have.
Well, you know, we all knew when we went into this inflationary cycle back a couple of years ago that we'd be in uncharted territory, because we really haven't dealt with this as an economy, even as a global economy for the most part, since, before our professional careers began, right?
Right.
And it's simply persisting for a lot longer, and maybe even coming back to an ever so slight extent as a, you know, as an item. And, you know, given the number of defense contracts that have been signed in a completely different environment, that really complicates things. And as you say, you know, attracting capital really complicates these things. Yeah, having said that, it would seem that if you're a new start company, it would be a much worse situation. You know, the good old days of lots of venture capital money blowing through SPACs and whatever else, that's clearly not just over, but dead, buried, and they're dumping additional dirt on top of the grave. That really complicates the new start aspect. Financing jetliners, yeah, you know, it's an issue, but it's not like people aren't willing to do it. You know, I mean, obviously it creates that even more inflationary environment because expectations for returns change. But on the other hand, you know, hard assets look really good in an inflationary environment. So people are just as enthusiastic, if not more so, about financing jetliners. So all in all, a difficult situation, more difficult for some, you know, but don't forget, as we discussed, I believe a couple of weeks ago, inflation isn't the same. It's not a rising tide or falling tide lifting all boats. Aerospace inflation tends to be a bit more vulnerable to, say, skilled labor or exotic materials or other stuff that's probably more inflated or inflating than other things, you know, I don't know, fast food or whatever. And that further complicates people's lives. So that shows up, of course, in, you know, lawsuits over titanium and whatever else. But all of this, you know, helps create ripple effects throughout the system that complicates relationships between suppliers and OEM and primes. Because, of course, you've got the inevitable, hey, you've got inflation pass-through provisions. Why aren't you passing some of that down to us and whatever else? So it makes for a somewhat tense operating environment, I expect.
Speaking of tense operating environment, Ron, walk us through earnings and maybe start us off with Boeing. Sash, want to get your take on Airbus, and certainly Richard, yours as well, because it was a big week across the board. And you mentioned, you know, number of companies that were basically down. Anyway, talk to us about some of the drivers, what Boeing management had to say that you found surprising, and indeed the street found surprising. And then why some of these specific companies were as down as they were. You know, which I always find fascinating.
Yeah. So let's start with Boeing. You know, on Boeing, when the stock kind of in the pre-market, when it opened, the stock was up. And so, you know, where did Boeing beat expectations, right? Because earnings are kind of this sort of silly expectations game. Their defense business did a little bit better than what people were thinking. The commercial business burned up a little bit less cash than what people were thinking. I think they burned up about $3.9 billion as opposed to a little over $4 billion. And the services business did okay. So it seemed like kind of on balance, everything was okay. Then the call with management happened. And during the calls, when the stock started to really trade off, and you know, by the end of the day, it sold off pretty well. So what did management say that kind of got people thinking? One was, and this was a market change, when we interviewed Brian West at our conference, our industrials conference in London, you know, Brian had mentioned about how they were going to finance the Spirit deal, that they wouldn't be doing equity. He changed his view on that completely this quarter. So he said, hey, you know, equity could be on the table. We really have to think about how we're going to finance this thing, because we want to preserve our investment grade rating. And the context here, Vago, and I think this is important, when he said that at our conference in London, pretty much every fixed income investor, and you know, for those folks that don't know that, that's a bond investor, the folks that are owning Boeing's debt. When Brian said that at the conference in London, they all kind of groaned simultaneously, right? Like across the board, there was a broad cheering of WTF. So Boeing heard that. You know, the debt community wants Boeing to finance Spirit with equity. The equity community wants Boeing to finance it with debt. The reality is, if they finance it with debt, there's a real chance that their debt could get downgraded from investment grade to junk status. And just yesterday, I think it was, or 2 days ago, Moody's downgraded their debt. And that in and of itself wasn't a surprise. They just kind of went in line with the other companies, just sort of a click, or the other rating agencies, just a click above junk. But this was the part that was a surprise. They put a negative outlook on it. Now, if Boeing's debt were to go down to, you know, leave investment grade and go down to high yield junk status, that would change their borrowing costs very dramatically. It would change various programs they have with suppliers in terms of how they do payment structures and things. So it would be very, very disruptive. So, you know, kind of what's new here is, you know, Boeing might have to do some equity to finance the Spirit deal to keep the you know, the bond vigilantes, or whatever you want to call that, happy. And an interesting thing about the bond market is, the bond market's very, very patient. You know, a lot of debt was taken on 4 years ago, and they're very, very patient. And then one day they wake up and they're like, where's our money? And they become less patient very quickly. And I think we're starting to see that happen. So Boeing has to deal with that reality. Anyway, that sent the shares lower. When you look at other companies that reported, a lot of it was just company specific stuff. You know, Northrop had a nice across the board quarter. Pretty much top line revenue was better. Most places margins were better, and you know, the stock performance reflected that. Textron was off a lot more than, you know, it was off a surprising amount. And I think that was just some concerns around business jet deliveries and timing and things that I honestly don't think should have been a concern. GD reported they had a fine quarter. They didn't give a guide for this year. They have never given a guide in the first quarter. For some reason, people got it in their head that they should give a guide in the first quarter, but they never, ever do that. And that kind of sent the shares down. So there was just a lot of weird trading dynamics going on. But I would say broadly for the group, numbers weren't bad. Reasonable top lines. Margins were okay. So I think the setup into the rest of the year looks pretty good. And, several of the companies were willing to give some taste of what the supplemental that just got approved could mean for them, right? So there's, I always hate to frame it this way, but there's some goodies in there for GD. There's some goodies in there for Northrop Grumman. There's some stuff in there for Raytheon, particularly around, munitions and missiles and, filling inventories back up. So I think that's where we were.
And solid also for Lockheed, right? I mean, when it comes to munitions,
refilling. I did not mean to lead Lockheed out of that. Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Although I think your point is a good one, right? When investors get into this like weird mode, all of a sudden, it's like, yeah, but they never do that. Well, they should have, they never do it. So, you know what I mean? I mean, I think it's interesting that it's like, well, they've never given you that guidance. Well, we think they should give us that guidance. Okay.
I'd like
a pony too, anyway, you don't always get what you want. Sash, walk us through from a European perspective, and particularly what we saw from Airbus and what you thought was interesting about what they had to say. And I should also point out, right, Saab also I think reported, so walk us through there as well.
Yeah, actually I'll do Saab first of all and then get back to Airbus and really the read across to Boeing, because I think that's what's been fascinating about these Q1s. I mean, Saab, a fantastic quarter, another quarter of a book-to-bill of well over 1.3 times, backlog of an all-time high. They've raised their revenue guidance, and the earnings guidance sort of mathematically goes up from that. So, if you want to think of companies that are at the sweet spot of the early stage of European defence rearmament, which is what's happening at the moment, you've got to look for companies that make weapons. You've got to look for companies that make radars. If you are a radar manufacturer in Europe at the moment, you can produce it and you will sell it at a really good profit. You can name your price because customers are just beating to the door and saying, we want pretty much any radar, air surveillance, ground surveillance, naval that you can produce. And so they're not going through the usual process of competition. They're not going through the usual process of haggling over price or anything like that. They just want them and they want them now, preferably yesterday. And Saab is really benefiting from that. Who else should be benefiting from that? Well, we know Hensoldt in Germany is, because they are sending radars out not just to Germany, but also to Ukraine at pretty much every month at the moment. Thales should be doing well from this. We'll see next week. Leonardo should be doing well from this. They've been much quieter about it. But certainly in Northern Europe, it's boom time for radar manufacturers. And it's boom time for ammunition manufacturers. Right, let's get back to civil now and Airbus. The Airbus numbers were, frankly, pretty weak. It wasn't a terribly interesting quarter. But Airbus sets quite a high bar at the moment for all this. But it wasn't a very good quarter. Essentially, they have shifted a fair number of deliveries, or they're certainly going to be more weighted towards Q2, Q3, and even more Q4. And that's when the profits get made. So, bit of negative cash flow as they build up stocks. What I thought was really interesting about the Airbus numbers, though, was that actually about how they talk about their business and how they talk about their balance sheet. It was very interesting just listening to the Boeing call yesterday, as Ron said, and thinking, this feels to me like a company that is much closer to a credit event than anybody should feel remotely comfortable with. And the fact that, you know, Boeing's down to its last $7 billion of cash or thereabouts, that's a really, really unpleasant figure. And just, you know, comparisons. Boeing has got 42, I think, billion of net debt at the moment. Airbus has got 9 billion euros of, so really effectively $10 billion of net cash. In terms of liquidity, Airbus has got about 30 billion of liquidity. So about four times what Boeing has got at the moment. And Airbus is absolutely adamant that to run a civil aircraft company, you know, responsibly, safely, whatever you want to call it, they've got to have an investment grade rating, exactly what Brian West is saying, and they've got to have 10 billion of net cash, you know, pretty much going through. They can't just give it back to shareholders. And they've got to have this big liquidity buffer behind that. It really is. It's an astonishing contrast to the situation that Boeing's got itself into, where, you know, we're clearly worried about what price they refinance at the debt and what price they do an equity issue at. Airbus isn't in that situation at the moment. Looking at their balance sheet, that just shows what really a responsible civil aircraft company should be looking at. Because as the Airbus CFO always says, you never know when you're going to get what, you know, we used to laugh and call a sort of black swan event. Actually, it's not. It's much more frequent than that. But a really bad event that knocks this industry and your cash just pours out of the door for many quarters. Airbus and Boeing both had that with COVID. Boeing had that with the MAX. You've got to have a big balance sheet.
Indeed. And what I think is kind of interesting about this is that, you know, there was a sense that that Boeing's financial situation was a little bit stronger than it is, which I find fascinating. Richard, you have your hand up, but actually you don't have to hold your hand up because I was going to call on you anyway. And you can now discuss luxuriously. Lay it on, because I mean, I think there are so many different sub elements and sub themes of this that are, I think, worth plumbing. Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh boy. I mean, talk about burying the lead. Is I believe you
run free, folks. Richard. Run free.
You know, one of the more, shall we say, unusual questions I get from, say, other journalists and investors who are perhaps new to this space, and maybe some industrial clients who don't really know aerospace because they're multi-industry or what have you. Is Boeing too big to fail? How troubled is Boeing? Will the government need to rescue Boeing? That sort of thing. That's the sort of thing that happens when your product is truly screwed, which that is not the case, as I'm constantly saying. There's nothing wrong with the MAX 8. People want it. Or your end user market is truly screwed. That is not the case here. My God, it's quite the opposite. People can't get jets fast enough, and they quite right. like the MAX 8, and they'd love to have a MAX 10. This is, you know, you turn on MAX 8 production and you get MAX 10 out the door and start turning that production on too. And this is a license to mint money. You know, we've done for years now, you know, cash flow projections on the basis of various production rates. That's kind of a large part of what we do to assess industry health. And oh my God, no problem. In other words, this is an artificial crisis brought about by desperately incompetent management. They can't deliver jets, so they can't bring in cash, so they have a troubled balance sheet. This is what it is. This is not a crisis of interest rates. This is not a crisis of a failed market. This is not a crisis of a failed product. This is a crisis of desperate incompetence. That is the whole point why they need new leadership. It's really not a lot more than that.
But if I may, we have been talking about this, that this is a wreck a long time in coming, right? They can't find the paperwork. They can't find the paperwork because we're finding people in the company. We're saying folks were robbing Peter to pay Paul, move stuff around. Hey, it was all about getting stuff out the door, you know, whether you were using Dawn dish soap, cheesecloth, or hotel entry cards, right, as measuring things. By the way, some of those could actually be brilliant, right? Or, holy crap, you know, you were trying to use everything even at hand in order to be able to try to do this faster. It took us a while to get here, Ron, and I'm going to come to you in just a moment, right? how long does it take you to get out of it? You can have a really good product, but it would seem to me that what we're recognizing and what people in the company are saying is, you know, and we've been talking about this for some time, right? That wrong people were promoted to the wrong jobs, right? Ted Culpert, I'm not being his agent on this. You know, he's owning it and that's great. And we're seeing some turnaround there in the defense business. But at the end of the day, right, a lot of the wrong people were put into a lot of the wrong jobs. And that appears to have been the case on the commercial side of the business as well. So how long does it take you to work through that? I got the management part. Light bulb goes off. You start visiting the production floor and you're starting to take it seriously. But how long before like this turnaround happens in a meaningful way that starts pushing these airplanes out the door with the degree of confidence that has the FAA saying, yay, you guys are off of triple secret probation?
But that's just it. Ted Colbert does seem to have had that moment. And that does appear to be getting at least a little bit better. At least the losses weren't that bad this quarter. I don't think commercial's there yet. And certainly at the top, they need to set that tone, that things need to change. And that hasn't happened. So how long will this take? Some time. But as we've discussed many times before, cultural change happens at the top. And that top change hasn't happened yet. Quite the opposite. The shock news on the call was that Calhoun is being forced out by very angry customers. Let's not sugarcoat this. Somehow has a role in the selection process, and somehow he has selected somebody that he would like to see, and that person looks an awful lot like him. How is this okay? Right.
So who is the right who? I'm going to let you say this since you started it. Who's the person who seems to have been selected?
Well, looks he a was, lot like you know, clearly advocating, you know, Stephanie Pope, right? I mean, and that I'm sure she's a nice person, but you have someone who's very badly discredited by, of all people, the most important set of customers, and their selection of someone who has a background like them is somehow taken seriously. That's pretty shocking. Now, you're right. A lot of bad people were appointed, a lot of bad processes were put in place, and a lot of, a lot of flaws were baked into the system across the board. That has to change, but it has to start changing at the top. And that'll take years, but it has to start. And until then, they're just going to lurch from crisis to crisis, just like this balance sheet crisis that Sash and Ron talk about. That's the sort of crisis that emerges when you don't, you know, when you're not on the road back to industrial health.
Ron?
Again, just let me add on to what Richard said. I mean, I agree with, his commentary, but, how long does it take? It's going to take a long time because it took a long time to get here. You can't fix it in a quarter. You can't fix it in a year. So we'll see. And it's not just getting the airplanes on the line out the door. It's preventing this from happening again and, setting the culture right. And that could take a very, very long time. It's going to take a lot of changes. And we've talked about, many of the things that would have to get done. Move the headquarters back to Seattle, that kind of thing. Have your leadership team, live in Seattle. How about that? Just kind of some basic changes. Maybe put the CEO's desk and the CFO and the whole leadership team on the factory floor in Renton. It kind of sends a message of commitment. So I don't think these chess pieces are hard to move, but it's going to take time. And then on top of this, you got the complication of the negotiation with labor. We'll see what happens with the IAM. If I were a betting man, I'd say they're going to go on strike. So you got that. That's going to happen early in September. I think their contract ends September 12th. And then you're going to try to close the Spirit deal, which kind of makes things complicated and brings with it. Now, I would argue this. I hear this, too big to fail. Yes, Boeing is too big to fail, but they're not too big to be mediocre, right? And when I think about, GM today, versus GM when, we were all little kids, GM was a much bigger force to be reckoned with. GM didn't go away. They're still here, but they have a much smaller piece of the market. Can you imagine a world 20, 30 years from now where Boeing is still out there, Boeing is still making airplanes, but they just have a much smaller piece of the share, either because the other guy got a lot bigger or there's new entrants in that time frame that takes some share. Right.
Well, Northrop Grumman, for example, right? I mean, if this Jet Zero thing actually works out, you could be looking at a very different future. And we have a tendency of, you know, it's like, well, Douglas, a lot of very big names in this business don't make airliners anymore. They're subsumed into larger organizations, whether it's Airbus. Douglas is part, you know what I mean? Lockheed sort of got out of the business. Northrop was in it a long time ago, right? So things change.
But let me tell you this, like if Embraer had a 200 seat narrow body today, like a reasonably modern 200 seat narrow body, I guarantee you that United and American would each be ordering about 200 of those airplanes each, like tomorrow. Right. The airplane doesn't exist right now, but you know, if it did, so there is ample room for a third player. And you can imagine a world 30 years from now where Boeing is just a smaller player. And, you know, ultimately, you know, for the sake of Boeing and so on and so forth, you don't want that to happen. So to prevent that from happening, they have to make changes today because, right, like we've discussed before, product development in this industry takes a long time. Product life cycles take a long time. You make one bad decision today, you'll be paying for it in 20 or 30 years.
Right. If things are going to change, if things are to stay the same, they're going to have to change. Speaking of change and new entrants. Ron, start us off. The U.S. Air Force announced the two finalists in its very rapid program, born about 2 years ago, to develop a new generation of unmanned combat drone that can be operated autonomously. It's an adjunct to the next generation air dominance aircraft. The Air Force has stayed on a remarkable schedule to drive this thing forward. They want about 1,000 of them. And producibility is paramount because Air Force Secretary Kendall has made it clear this is going to go into service quickly. And I think that people don't fully recognize how fast the next generation air dominance program is moving. That's going to be down selected soon. And I believe first unit, you know, equip is like 2028 or something, right? So everybody's on an aggressive schedule. The winners, Kendall also has been saying for years, he wants industry to invest more and buy back less. And interestingly, the two winners are General Atomics and Anduril, two companies that put skin in the game. We know that the General Atomics aircraft is based on the OBSS. The company has a reputation for innovation and delivering. Anduril is the startup and everybody's wondering what it's pitched. You know, is it the Blue Force Fury or a derivative of it? Highly likely. But the company also has hired a lot of very good engineers from General Atomics and elsewhere. Production chief from Tesla, right? So it's a company that has both been putting its own investment in it, has raised money for this, but also, you know, telegraphing, you know, as we heard the company's Chris Bros say at CSIS, right? Some great marketing before you know you'll win. You know, if we don't get picked, then the department's not really serious about innovation. Well, I guess the Air Force has it always. It delivered a message that it can, you know, turn to other different, more innovative suppliers than the bigs, right? Boeing, Northrop, Lockheed didn't make it. It can say to an Anduril, hey, okay, we picked you. Now show us what you got. You know, at the end of the day, the Air Force also can get kind of a leap ahead capability that it's been seeking, given the, you know, the General Atomics airplane, at least we know, has a kind of a modular core architecture that's easily adaptable. Anyway, Ron, walk us through what, you know, you get a sense on the takeaways, because I think this was a very significant selection, ultimately, with a lot of messaging in it.
Yeah, I don't disagree with it. The kind of one of the initial kind of ways I was framing it, sort of like David versus Goliath, and David won. Not having any of the old guard in this really sends a strong message to, you know, the old guard that the Air Force wants to try new things, do things new ways. And, you know, to General Atomics and Anduril, I hope, you know, all the success in the world, because if they have success on this, maybe that'll be a catalyst to change the way procurement works on some future programs to be kind of more rapid, more effective, so on and so forth. So we'll see. I'm with you 100% that there was a lot of signaling in this, because, you know, the players, you know, that we know, you know, brand L, brand N, they were all in this, and they were, you know, clearly not picked. So let's see how the teams that were picked to, and, you know, if they're successful, I think this could be, you know, a mark of some change in the way we procure things.
Richard, you joined us on the Air Power podcast last Thursday. The down select decision had happened, so you were nice enough to join us after close of business and at the end of a very busy day. Give us your sense on what more we know, and after spending a couple of days thinking about it. And Sash, if you want to weigh in on this, on what possible lessons there could be, if you're European and you're watching this entire equation, because what I think is admirable is, I think people are really missing it. The Pentagon is moving a lot faster across a lot more fronts than people give it credit for. That's all I'm going to say. I'm not trying to be Pollyanna about it, but it begins with change, to your point, Richard. And it looks like there is change. Like, the wheel is turning a lot faster, I think, than people recognize it is. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Strategic motivations play a big role here. If we don't have some way to rebalance the quantitative mismatch in the Western Pacific, U.S. power is under a great deal of pressure. And obviously, CCA is a great way to leverage a technological lead, particularly with sensors and AI and everything else, in order to, leverage that, leverage the technology to make that mismatch in sheer numbers of platforms a bit better. And of course, speed is of the essence, because, obviously this is the decade of competition between the U.S. and China in that part of the world, and it's, obviously not going to get any better. I think they sent a very powerful message: invest IRAD rather than give away, be commercially agile. And something we learned back in the early days of the UAV, having low overhead helps an awful lot. So it's more than just investing IRAD. It's also just having a low overhead way of thinking, and having a company structure that is conducive to mass production of cheap air vehicles, rather than something that's fundamentally more expensive. It could be that Boeing, Northrop, and Lockheed play a role of some sort in CCA, probably one or two or three. But in terms of getting things started with large numbers of air vehicles up front, or these two appear to be perhaps a better bet from, an industrial structure standpoint. Anduril, God, who knows? We'll find out just how quickly, a Silicon Valley firm can get into this. And maybe they've got something, maybe they don't. And, GA, of course, they've been, I guess they've been the proven market entrant, sadly, this whole, new market entrant that the airframe industry has seen for how many decades now. So I think I'd put my money on them succeeding more, but Anduril is a fascinating story, and we'll see.
Exactly. Right. From the Air Force's perspective, I'm going to, even right now, I know I can get an airplane that's going to satisfy the mission. So now I have a competition and can, put a little bit of pressure on GA. I can split that by, I mean, the Air Force has sort of suggested it might do that because it's trying to get to that quantity. It may be easier for each company to build 500 of them than build 1,000 of them. So, there you can sort of split the difference if you really want to try to get it across the finish line more quickly. You give the shot to the new entrant, put up or shut up, right? I mean, it would seem to be a win-win-win, as a friend of mine kind of pointed out. General Atomics was Anduril before Anduril, and if the team there was wearing Hawaiian shirts and flip-flops, maybe they might have been seen a little bit differently. But anyway, it's kind of enriching to sort of see that, hey, look, there are opportunities and options here. And by the way, the bigs are going to be perfectly fine. Lockheed is seen as a front runner in next generation air dominance. It already has F-16s, F-35s, F-22s, other black programs, and now it might win this, or Boeing wins it, Northrop's got B-21, right? I mean, so even from an industrial policy standpoint, even if they say there's no industrial strategy here, there's plenty of work to go around, right, for the bigs ultimately. I mean, would you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. It reminds me of the Joint Strike Fighter days, where, the message sent by Lockheed Martin was, if you don't pick us, we might not be in the fighter business in 10 years. But if you don't pick Boeing, well, they'll still be an airframe designer and integrator, courtesy of their, at the time, thriving jetliner business. So that's probably another message, or, motivation, or what have you, going on here, that if you don't encourage these new start companies, not only them, but other new start companies might get the message that, hey, this industry is the domain of the big guys, and why bother? So I think it's, you know, a very strong kind of an inverse industrial base message to send that you got to promote newcomers and, you know, there's, and just regard the existing primes as having plenty of work. Now you contrast today with, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s, the JSF incept era. And my God, there really is an embarrassment of riches today. So that's exactly right. The big three don't have to worry about where their next meal is coming from the way they did, say, in 1999.
And the other thing, I mean, I just get this sense that these are companies that kind of want to change the world, right? As opposed to just purely make money. And they're both private companies. So, right, they can absorb, they can have a different kind of path. Making money is a different measure of merit to them than it is maybe for the bigger companies, even though the bigger companies, I think, can move money left pocket, right pocket with a little more agility, ultimately. Sash, what do you see watching this from the other side of the Atlantic as, you know, Europe does try to emulate some of these trends and capabilities, even if the Pentagon is moving ahead with it at a speed and a scale and kind of a focus. Although there will be an increment too that will involve allies and partners, right? Where people say, hey, Boeing's going to have a shot in this, and, you know, and everybody else who, you know, didn't make it this time can compete in the next tranche. But what's your sense watching this?
Europe finds it very hard to compete because we just don't have the swathe of large, innovative private companies that the US has. So if you look at comparable, vaguely comparable programs to CCA, they're all in the hands of the primes. In Europe, and they're moving at a pretty glacial pace. I would say Europe feels again half a cycle behind, and I can't see this announcement changing that very much. You know, the example that distresses me most of all is the degree to which in the Franco-German Spanish FCAS program, the loyal wing person has been tied up into the whole program. So the whole program has to develop a manned aircraft. It's got to develop a loyal wing person. It's got to develop a combat cloud. And it is so heavily integrated that no part of the program can move any faster than the slowest bit of the program, and hence started off 5 years behind Tempest, and it'll end up being 8 or 9 years behind Tempest. It's a very sort of statist way of doing things, but I can't see that changing very much because if Europe is going to pursue the sort of strategic autonomy that French President Emmanuel Macron was talking about again at the Sorbonne this week, we're going to have to make our own mistakes and make them at a pretty slow pace. You know, this isn't going to be an importable product for Europe because ITAR will be an issue. You know, you may have a handful bought for effectively as a sort of, you know, a series of golden bullets, but it's not going to be mass importable, I suspect. So, you know, we're going to have to do it some other way, and I suspect that will take some time. Europe's actually just got more, you know, higher priorities at the moment, which tend to be basic force structure and mass, and this is a second order issue.
You raised Macron's address, so thank you very much for skating to where the puck is about to go. Obviously, he's making these statements, and he addressed soon after taking office in 2017 Sorbonne. So this was kind of a 7-year bookend kind of a engagement where he did echo some of the same themes. Folks in the Elysee and elsewhere have pointed out this is not being anti-American. He's just looking at sort of where we are strategically. And quite honestly, I agree with the French president. The United States was the biggest driver of global rules-based free trade order. Richard, you are a stalwart disciple of that, and I think all of us are. But at the end of the day, just as everybody was getting to that strict rules-based global order thing, the Chinese were messing with it, and now two American successive administrations are becoming increasingly protectionist. I don't so much have a problem with his strategic investment thing, right? If Europe wanted to put money together, and indeed they did put money together, and Airbus is what it is today, because of a long time industrial strategy and investment to help create a competitive European commercial aerospace sector. If Europe put its mind to it, it could do this in defense, in other segments as well. I would say space succeeds in part because there is little strategic focus there. Does Macron's, you know, and we should put say that roughly at the same time the French president was making a speech, the British prime minister was announcing more money for defense for the UK, something which I think both parties, as they go into this election campaign, agree should happen. Does Macron's rhetoric move any European needle at this point, you think, the way that it should be moved? And then follow up with whether Sunak's call is affordable. We discussed this on last week's show, and your big question was, he can say anything he wants. The question is whether or not the resources will be there, given where the UK is now, post-Brexit, post-pandemic, post-everything else.
Okay, Macron, first of all. There's a degree of sort of wry amusement about Macron's calls now. I mean, he's, you know, in US political parlance, he's a lame duck president. He's not, you know, he's coming towards the end of his term, or certainly in the, you know, well into the second half of it. He's not, he can't stand for re-election again, so he can actually say what he wants, which is great. And I can't disagree with a huge amount of what he says. But one of the questions has always been, well, why didn't you do more of this earlier on? His first Sorbonne speech in 2017, you know, around half of the things that he talked about ultimately worked out in various ways within Europe. But yeah, you know, European sovereignty and European industrial capabilities are very important, but very, very hard to do. There's quite an interesting difference, though, between Airbus and defence in Europe. Airbus was created out of European weakness. European civil aircraft companies had failed. We had failure of the Caravelle, failure of the Mercure, failure of the VC-10 and the BAC-111. Europe couldn't do anything else but to come together. In defence, do we need a large Euro defence company? No, we don't, because the market is growing, and the market is growing incredibly fast. What we need is all the companies that we've got to be adequately funded, to be given some proper visibility by governments. Saab's CEO, Mikael Johansson, today was just saying, look, we cannot invest large amounts of money on new facilities if we don't get guarantees that there will be minimum offtake, and that we, European defence, won't be left high and dry in 10 years' time and told to cut back to or into the bone later. That's really what's needed. But the demand is there, whereas the demand was not there for the European civil aircraft industry when it was a fragmented Franco-British and everybody else affair. So I always worry about the idea that you take Airbus as the model for everything that is everything that should be done in the future. The other interesting thing about Macron is Macron has gone from being pretty soft on Russia and Ukraine. He gave an unfortunate impression of being a bit of an appeaser of Russia before and even after the invasion of Ukraine. And he's now become very, very hard line again. Maybe that's because he can afford to, because he's not worried about being elected. But he's taking his time to get there. However, very, very welcome that he does. As we discussed last week, European aid to Ukraine has got to go. It's probably got to double, if not more than that. UK, France are each spending about, you know, paying about 2 to 3 or 3 to 4 billion a year to Ukraine. It's probably got to be closer to 10 each. And Germany is up towards there, and there's also got to be more. Those are big asks to make. UK defence. I think what's changed this week is that the dog didn't bark. And the dog that didn't bark was the UK Labour Party, the opposition party, which had every opportunity over the weekend and into this week to say, whatever Rishi Sunak says about defence, we're not for it. We're going to win the next election, which is clearly what they hope. And we'll make our own decisions then. And they didn't. They actually, you know, effectively, tacitly signed off on 2.5% of GDP on defence. And, you know, we'll sort out the numbers later. And if you know, the Chancellor in the UK is an incredibly important politician. The Chancellor effectively has got total control of the purse strings and sometimes knows much more about what's going on than the Prime Minister does, and sometimes doesn't even tell the Prime Minister. But if the current Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, and the Shadow Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, have both basically signed off on this, then the Treasury will go along with it by hook or by crook. I will be paying more tax. That's the unfortunate bit about it. And there'll be a lot more government, UK government debt, but there is always debt in a defence build-up. It's really unfortunate fact. The bond markets, you know, that may be part of the realisation that we're starting to see this week.
And what I find interesting is the more you spend, the more quickly you spend it, the less your buying power is, in part because the price of everything goes up because you're, you know, having to rebuild capacity. Everybody is used to boutique production and the like. So that, and that's one of the things we're seeing here, I think, in the United States. I would also point out to people, if I may use a little bit of my British history knowledge, right? I think it's fascinating that number 11 Downing Street is the second Lord of the Treasury, who is the Chancellor, and the first Lord of the Treasury is the Prime Minister, which I always think that the British system managed to get it right. You've got the boss, and then you've got the money guy sitting next to the boss.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But you know what? Sometimes, in actuality, those roles are reversed.
Yes, and much to the lamentation of the person who sits often in number 10.
Absolutely.
His next door neighbor is more powerful than he is or she is. And as we're recording this on Friday, there's a little bit of breaking news. It looks like Boeing is going to acquire, or maybe we should say reacquire, the factory that it originally sold to GKN. That's also led to several lawsuits on F-15s and on F-18s. Ron, your take on what this means, right? Because if they're buying this back, they're buying back Spirit, right? Do we see a pattern maybe? Talk to us about the deal in particular and what it means.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can look at it and quickly say, hey, you know what, they're buying back Spirit and this is happening and they're, you know, following a different strategy. I don't know if that's exactly true, right? I guess to the law, it's true, right? You know, but if you look at why they're buying this back, GKN was threatening to shut it down and it's a sole source plant for, you know, components for F-18s and F-15s. F-18, I think what they got extended a little bit out to 2027, probably be around given what happened to F-A-X-X a little bit longer, and F-15 and X version is pretty active in an international market. So it's a critical supply plant for Boeing. So one, it solves that issue. And two, I think they've got about 550, 600 employees there. And we're in a market, as we've discussed many times on the podcast, that's really short on aerospace talent. Particularly, you know, machine shop talent. So you get both, right? You know, Boeing's getting, you know, solving the issue with the fighters and also getting some talent. So, you know, it makes a ton of sense. The Spirit thing's a lot different. You know, this wasn't so much a quality thing as opposed to, all right, we get employees and we're solving this issue and the lawsuits go away, presumably.
Well, it's just about sort of this tendency of bringing work back into the company, right? I mean, critical capabilities, bring them back in the company, especially if, you know, you sold them and whoever you sold them to is going to get rid of them.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, this whole concept of, you know, outsourcing too much, I Brian West even said it, you know, at our conference in London, our industrial conference, that, you know, maybe Boeing took this too far in terms of outsourcing. So I think, you know, that for sure is incontrovertible.
Guys, thanks so very much for joining us. Really appreciate it, as we always do. Have a great remainder of the weekend. Have a great week. We look forward to having you guys back on again next week. To our audience, thanks very much for spending time with us. We always appreciate it. And before we go, a quick word from all of our sponsors. The Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by Bell, HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. And a reminder to check out our award-winning weekly podcast, Cavas Chips, hosted by Chris Cavas and Chris Cervello, and sponsored by HII and GE Aerospace, who clear the fog on naval and maritime matters. The Downlink with Laura Winter, sponsored by TE Connectivity, who takes a thoughtful look at all things space, and our Air Power podcast, sponsored by GE Aerospace, that I co-host with our own JJ Gertler. Thanks very much again. We'll be back again tomorrow with the Look Ahead podcast with Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners. Until then, hope everybody has a great day. Thanks very much. See you soon.